This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
This podcast is brought to you with support from the Mark Sanders Foundation. We live in an increasingly uncertain and complex world with a casual attitude towards objective facts. Citizens often don't know what the truth is or where to find it. The Mark Sanders Foundation has the toolkit to address this global issue, philosophy. Through academic excellence and inclusive outreach programmes, the Mark Sanders Foundation helps deepen understanding through innovation in philosophy for a more informed world. Learn more at www.marksandersfoundation.org. And that's Mark with a C, M-A-R-C, sandersfoundation.org.
What's the best way to do practical ethics? What's the best way to work out how we should behave morally in different scenarios? Some philosophers like to start by developing principles, often through the use of imaginary examples called thought experiments. James Wilson, who teaches at University College London, believes this gets things the wrong way round.
James Wilson, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hello.
The topic we're going to focus on is real-world ethics. Now, obviously, all ethics in some sense is in the real world, but what do you mean by real-world ethics?
I mean helping us to make wise decisions about real-life situations. Very often philosophers can talk about thought experiments or in very abstract terms, but the real world is actually much more complicated than the world that philosophers often like to think about.
So a classic example of a thought experiment is the trolley problem with the runaway train going towards five people on the tracks, and you could deflect it by putting a lever up to kill one person instead, should you do it. That's very, very much a simplified situation. It's almost like a diagram in most examples. How is a real-world problem different from that?
A real-world problem is different in all kinds of ways from a thought experiment. The first way, perhaps most obviously, is all real-world problems arise in a context and within a certain history. Think about the way that the thought experiment is set up. You're just told that this trolley is hurtling down towards five people and you're at the points. You don't understand anything about why it was that the trolley is hurtling towards that. When we never discover anything about what will happen to the five people who get saved afterwards. Whereas real-world problems are massively more complicated than that. Think, for example, if you're trying to provide ethical advice on somebody trying to solve a problem like the Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East. It's a problem that goes back 100 or more years, and there's such a sort of history of recrimination on both sides that you couldn't begin to think that through in ethical terms without understanding the history.
As I understand it, one of the values of simplified thought experiments is that you can establish general principles which you might then apply to more complex situations.
Indeed, that's the theory that philosophers give us. In some cases, there may be something to that. James Rachels has a classic thought experiment involving two people, Smith and Jones, and he's interested in, is there really a difference between actively killing somebody and letting them die? And so he sets up two precisely matched cases where the only difference is that in one case there's a killing and in another case letting die. And most people think that, okay, yes, in that particular scenario constructed, there doesn't seem to be a moral difference between killing and letting die. But the question is, what follows from that? Does it follow that there's never a difference between killing and letting die? I think that's too hasty a thing to draw, and that very often context matters and there can be other principles which interact in complicated ways. And so that there's often a very deep set of questions, an important set of questions that we need to think about as philosophers about, well, how do you go from the simple case where things are clear to the real world case?
So would you advocate getting away from thought experiments? Are they a distraction from real world ethics?
I think in some ways, yes, but in other ways, no. So that I think the philosophers could do a lot by actually looking at the way that experiments are used in science. So that philosophers talk often in grand ways about thought experiments, and it makes it sound as if what they're doing is scientific. But you need to look very closely at the way that, for example, randomized clinical trials are used in testing for drug safety. A well-designed clinical trial, it will tell you something about the effect of that drug on the particular trial population. But the particular trial population will often be quite specific, and it may be different from the people who actually finally want to use the drug to help. So that often the people inside the drug population may be, for example, men between the age of 20 and 30 who are otherwise healthy, whereas the person the doctor has in front of them may be a much older woman with lots of other things wrong with her. And it may be an open question what the evidence from the clinical trial says about what would help this particular woman. I think a similar principle will apply to thought experiments as well. It may be that you can establish something about a very specific and pared down case by using your thought experiment. You can show, for example, that in a world in which there really is a trolley hurtling towards you and all you can do is either pull a lever or choose not to pull a lever, then maybe you should pull the lever in order to save the five and let the one die. But what that tells you about cases of killing and letting die in real world situations, for example, in war, is very much up for grabs.
So what's the alternative?
I think there's a number of alternatives. Maybe the beginning of wisdom is to adopt a kind of pluralism, to think about the sort of tools that you have available to you. No tool will be good for all sorts of problems or challenges. And again, to revert back to the way that a scientist might think, that a scientist is going to say, well, okay, well, sure, there's all sorts of things that we can do with a randomised clinical trial. But they're going to say, well, we need real-world evidence in addition to that, so that we have to be aware of the sorts of things that we can get out of certain sorts of experiments and then calibrate those so that we don't put too much weight on them. I think that there are other sorts of techniques or ways of doing philosophy that don't rely so much on thought experiments. So, for example, you can look at very much richer cases. The use of literature is a good example. In that case, you have a world that's much more richly imagined. It's a world with real people, people often with history, people you can identify with and either sort of hate or love. And in doing so, you can get inside a philosophical problem, maybe about what love is or what sorts of things that we should regret, in a way that a thought experiment maybe never will be able to do.
It's interesting you described fictional characters as real people, because they aren't, are they? They're imagined. I mean, famously, someone wrote a paper about how many children had Lady Macbeth. There just isn't an answer. There's no right answer because it's never mentioned by Shakespeare. She's not like a real person who would have a specific number of children, and she only does what she does in the play. She doesn't do anything else.
Indeed. Maybe one thing to say is that a novel or a play is much more highly realised, much more highly thought out than a thought experiment. So there's a way that there's a real world that you can think your way into. And certainly if you're an actor playing the role of Lady Macbeth or Macbeth, that Shakespeare's given enough there for us to sort of empathise with and to be able to sort of build a backstory, understand what the character is like. I would completely agree that Shakespeare hasn't told us everything about those people's lives, and there's a lot that we need to fill in. But maybe that's just the beginning of wisdom, that it's never possible for somebody to tell us everything about a life. In fact, even for our closest friends or the family members, we don't know them completely either. Nonetheless, you can know people through knowing aspects of them. And that may be enough to do good moral philosophy with. It may be that you don't need to have an omniscient understanding of every single possible fact about somebody in order to be able to inhabit their world, to understand what it's like, and then use that as a way of reflecting ethically.
Whether you go to fictional characters, real people who have existed or do exist, it's still going to be much more complicated than a thought experiment. So how does a philosopher go about deciding what the right thing to do, if there is a right thing to do, is in a particular situation when it is so complex?
Oh, I think that's an extremely good question. I think you're right to flag up the difficulty about thinking about real world situations. In some ways, that's why it is that I think it's the most important form of ethical philosophy that we can do. The first thing to say, in which I've experienced a lot through the work I've done, particularly in public policy, is that you shouldn't think of it in the way that some philosophers do, that if you're just really, really smart and sit down at your table, drink a lot of tea and eat a lot of Jaffa cakes, then suddenly the answers will arrive. Rather, the answers you're looking for need to be constructed with the other people who are inside the problem situation. For two reasons. First of all, as a philosopher, you're typically not as smart as you think you are, that you're not as imaginative as you may think you are. And that a lot of the ethical problems and challenges that we face are actually due to the way that other people interpret the world and the way they think about it. So a problem I've been working on quite recently is the problem of how to make sure that you get enough people who are willing to be vaccinated, so that for something like, say, measles, in order to have herd immunity, you need to have at least 90% of the people vaccinated, maybe 95%. How do you ensure this? It's one thing as a philosopher to say, well, here's my ethical argument for it. But some people may not find that convincing, so that other people say, well, what we need to do is come up with an ethical argument for why it's okay for governments to coerce people in this kind of case. You begin to realise after a little bit that that may be actually quite counterproductive. It's something they began to try in France and in Italy recently, but in Italy in particular, that very governmental support for compulsory vaccination is part of what's led to the rise of the five-star movement. Taking steps which you think will improve compliance may in fact make it worse if you have a backlash. You have to really understand things from the ground level and realise that there may not be one way of getting at the objective you're looking at, but rather there may be a variety of plausible perspectives, some of which you've got to try out and talk to the people who are involved in the problem, see which one of them is going to work best.
Does that include talking to anti-vax people, people who are just refusing to vaccinate their children?
Of course. If you look about 5-10 years ago, there was a sort of a discourse of expertise where people imagined that almost in the way that English people do when they go abroad, as if they just weren't shouting loud enough. Is it what the expert needs? You get some even bigger experts with more white coats on and tell people that they were wrong. I think the beginning of wisdom is to begin to understand why is it that people hold the views that they do? If it seems to be irrational, what makes it rational for them? And in the case of something like anti-vax, it seems to be quite clearly related to maybe an overall collapse in faith in certain sorts of authority, just certain sorts of expertise or an unwillingness to take on trust the sorts of things that people in official positions tell them. Sometimes that may be deeply irrational, but there have been quite a number of cases over the last 10, 15 years where it's turned out that there have been official conspiracies. You think of something like sort of Abu Ghraib or what came out as a result of the Edward Snowden revelations, where it became clear that it wasn't at all irrational to think that there may be conspiracies. It seems that we aren't going to get any further merely by attempting to shout louder. Really what we need to do is work out how do you rebuild trust in science, in democratic institutions. And the one useful way of doing that might be rather than to focus on the idea of objectivity and knowledge, but rather to focus on the way in which trustworthiness is built within scientific discourse, to focus on the checks and the balances, the ways in which scientific knowledge and peer-reviewed science is itself a form of organised scepticism, so that rather than science being other to what you believe, if you're sceptical, you should be scientific.
That kind of engagement with a range of ideas gives you lots of information, and it might give you, as it were, rhetorical strategies for changing people's opinions. Where does the philosophy come in? Where's the ethics? What makes this ethics and not just nudging?
I think what makes it ethics is you have some concern for truth, for rationality. But I guess I should put my cards on the table. As a philosopher, I'm a pragmatist. So I tend to be very sceptical about the idea that philosophical truths are somehow out there to be grasped as if the truths have been there all along. Rather, I think that philosophical problems are largely socially constructed. One good example might be in the realm of epistemology. It's a really interesting fact that suddenly around the late 80s, early 90s, philosophers became deeply interested in testimony when there'd hardly been any writing on testimony within epistemology before. Now, why is that? And as a pragmatist, I think that the obvious answer to that is it's about the rise of the World Wide Web. Suddenly people had access to more and more information than they ever had before. And it raised questions about the trustworthiness of that information, how it's possible to get knowledge from sources that are far away that it's difficult to check, which had never really been so salient before. And I tend to think that's exactly what happens in lots of other philosophical arenas. A lot of my work has been in healthcare ethics. In the 1950s, as a result of attempts to control polio and find a way of treating people for it, you see the invention of the respirator. Now, with the respirator, you're suddenly able to keep people alive who would otherwise have died very quickly, but often for days, months, even years. All sorts of questions suddenly arise about the nature of death, which hadn't previously arisen. It may be that you can keep someone's heart pumping and blood going around their body, their skin pink, almost indefinitely, but their higher brain functions have completely stopped. Suddenly questions arise which require sort of philosophical thought, which hadn't really arisen before. And I think that that's what genuine philosophical theorising is all about. It's about working out what are the hardest and most difficult problems which have arisen in society that we can't deal with other sorts of means.
I know you've thought about using Twitter as a source of information for some of your research. Could you say something about that?
Yes. I was involved in a project a couple of years ago called iSense. What the project is trying to do is to build a new generation of ways of detecting and responding to disease, almost to build what they describe as an early warning system for disease detection. One of the things they became very interested in is what can we find out about disease detection, where diseases are going, from the sorts of things that people post onto Facebook or onto Twitter. One of the things that they were interested in doing seemed, on the face of it, completely innocuous. They wanted to take things that people had posted on Twitter, public things that anybody can search, and then use those as a way of tracking disease to see that you could work out, for example, how large a particular flu outbreak is or where it's moving to. In order to think this through, Benedict Rumbold and I, who are working on this project together, we looked at it a bit more broadly, and one of the things that we discovered is that things can be potentially much more controversial than you might imagine. Back in 2014, Samaritans, who are a well-known UK and Irish charity whose job it is to work in suicide prevention, had tried to do something very similar. They'd set up a system called Radar. If you signed up for Radar, it then monitored the tweets of everybody you were following, and then it gave you alerts if it thought that that person might be potentially suicidal. But many people felt that their privacy had been violated by this, despite the fact that all the information that was being used was in the public domain. It was things that people had tweeted out for their followers to see and which could be seen by anyone on the World Wide Web. And we became interested in this as a much broader phenomenon, what we describe as the phenomenon of privacy in public. So in order to answer a set of questions about sort of the detection of disease, we've discovered we were digging really deep philosophically into the nature of the right to privacy, the relationship between privacy and consent. In the article we published, we came to the conclusion that even when people do publish things, they typically have in mind a range of sorts of uses that might be made of that information and a sort of legitimate inferences that might be made from it. And that if the information is used in ways that go far beyond that, they may feel that their right has been violated, and we say that we think the right actually has been violated, despite that the information has been published. And I've noticed that the article has got quite a lot of traction, people beginning to talk about it, because obviously it has very clear implications for some of the ways of dealing that you have in advertising, perhaps the way that information is used in Facebook and elsewhere.
Is there any room for a kind of reflective equilibrium in your approach, where as you move between the particular and the more general, back from the general to the particular, there's a sense in what you've described so far is immersing yourself in the particular, but there must be pre-existing plausible premises, plausible generalisations that might come into play as well and feed back the other way.
I think that's very definitely the case. I think maybe I've been emphasising the ground level, the concrete elements, mostly because philosophers tend to do those badly, quite frankly. But yes, I often teach doctors, nurses, people who come to do my courses in the hope that it might be able to help them in various ways in their practice to have thought about some ethical theory or to think about, say, ethical issues in paternalism. And if all one was ever able to tell people is, well, attend to the particulars of the situation and use your judgment, then I think that ethics wouldn't be that useful. Or at least you need so many ethicists, one ethicist per problem almost, and you couldn't get any power that abstraction offers to give us. So I'd like there to be some way of going beyond merely looking at particulars. And I think that principles are very helpful in that, that there always does need to be that sense of reflective equilibrium, that we can't sort of assume that the principles we have are always going to be correct. And we have to be very much alive to the fact that something might have seemed to be a good principle, but then you try to use it in a more complicated scenario than you'd initially thought. And it turns out that the principle either gives you the wrong result, or you realise, in my experience much more commonly in philosophy, it turns out that the principle just isn't very helpful. It doesn't really specify what to do, or it turns out that the problem is so complicated that you can't really map the principle onto it in the first place.
How did you get into this style of ethical thinking? Was there something that drew you particularly to this way of thinking about ethical problems?
I think various things drew me in this way. Something I don't often talk about, but that before I did my PhD, in fact, I was thinking of becoming a playwright. And one of the reasons I wanted to be a playwright is I think I've always been interested in the texture and the weave of people's lives and the way they experience ethical problems and challenges within those lives. I think there's ways in which you can explore ethical questions within drama that it's quite difficult to do within philosophy sometimes. And so that in some of the emphasis that I've tried to place on use of literary examples, or insofar as you're going to use the thought experiment, make sure they're sort of rich ones where you can actually imagine the lives of the people. I wanted to find a way of bringing some of those sorts of ethical insights you can get from drama or from literature back into philosophy.
James Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us. We now have a few more podcasts. Nigel has one on philosophy and places they're associated with, www.philosophysites.com. And there's also Thinking Books, www.thinkingbooks.co. I have a podcast devoted specifically to moral and political philosophy, www.philosophy247.org. And there's one on the social sciences. Just Google Social Science Bites.